Eric Garcia has covered his share of campaigns over the years. He's written for Roll Call, for The Hill, for Washington Post, and he's sat through dozens of stump speeches and town halls as he's followed candidates around the country. In 2017, he was in Iowa at a steak fry put on by the local Democratic Party. He was interviewing Congresswoman Sherry Bustos from Illinois, an up-and-comer in the party. She was there to speak at the event.
So, like, first and foremost, you know, Sherry Bustos was a congressman from Illinois who was going to be speaking in Iowa. Usually I try to build commonalities when I'm talking with someone and I'm interviewing with them, doing like a sit-down interview with them. You know, she's from Illinois, I'm from Illinois, so we're both fans of the Chicago Cubs. And like, as soon as any politician goes to Iowa, you're like, oh, are they going to run for president? You know, like, she gave kind of a good non-answer answer. And then I said, like, what did the Democrats have to say to like a single mom raising a kid with autism, like my family? And then, like, we were talking, and then, like, after we were done, I turned off the recorder, and then she said, so what's it like to have autism? And that stuck with me because it was like, A, that shows one good thing, which is that she's curious, and we should want that from our elected officials. But B, it's like, how the hell do I explain this? But then C, it also shows that there's so much misunderstanding, like so few people really understand about it. It really is hard to kind of break things down and to kind of explain it to people.
And the answer you gave at first was kind of vague.
That question threw me off so much that I didn't know how to respond, to the point that I don't even remember it. And usually I have a photographic memory. So if I don't remember it, then that must mean it was really inconsequential, because that just stuck with me. And I thought about it in the hotel later that night.
What did you think about later? Because you mentioned, you write this in the book, that like, how am I going to explain
condition? Yeah, like, and then how do you also explain, like, oh, there's, it manifests in so many other ways. It, you know, there's not, no one autistic person is the same. And at the time I was working on this book proposal, so already that was going through my head. And then I thought to myself, you know, I'm a political journalist. You know, when I go back and I write this story about Iowa and about what Democrats need to do to win back the heartland, people are going to care about it, you know? And then I thought to myself, you know, if I write about autism from a political journalist perspective, and I really try to profile what it looks like to be autistic in America, maybe some people who can change something about it will care about it too, you know?
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Eric Garcia says the way we think about autism in this country, the way we make policy or interact with autistic people, is backward. This will come up in the interview, but most of the federal and private research money spent on autism is to find the cause or to find a cure. But Garcia told us that's not really what autistic people need. What they really need is, well, they need a job if they're able. They need education and proper health care. And they need not to be discriminated against. Garcia told us autistic people need to be free to pursue fulfilling personal lives. His book is called We're Not Broken.
What I wanted to talk about was, how do we talk about autism? And in turn, the way we talk about autism and ultimately winds up how we talk about autistic people. And is really a reflection of what we think about autistic people. So when you pass legislation like the Combating Autism Act, which was passed in 2006 and reauthorized in 2011, under a Democratic and Republican president, mind you, so two different presidents, We ultimately wind up talking about how to combat autistic people and how to mitigate the things that make autistic people. What I want to say is that autistic people are fine as is. They're not broken. They're not failed. They're not bad people. They're not something to be ashamed of. And that, yes, autistic people may have impairments, just like blind people or just like deaf people or just like people in wheelchairs, but they themselves are not broken. And we should not try to and we should work to limit, to reduce those impairments, but also make the world adaptable, just like we do for disabled people.
Yeah. I want to get to some of the myths that seem to persist about autism. But first, I wanted to ask you about something you write really early in the book. Because you say this, you say, when it comes to dispelling myths, you're beginning with yourself.
Yeah.
Explain what you mean.
The way that I'm starting with myself is that I think that, a lot of people don't think that there are autistic adults. And then B, there are a lot of people who think that the autistic adults that they do know are all like almost like Sheldon Cooper type mathematician geniuses, or they're detectives in television shows, or you know, Sherlock, like basically Sherlock Holmes is basically autistic, you know, or some way or on one way or another, they're this kind of thing. And then also predominantly, the people who are portrayed as autistic are mostly white. And they mostly come from upper class affluent families. In fact, in a lot of ways, I remember Leo Kanner, who put out the first major widely read study in English about autism, Autistic Disturbances of Affective Contact. Of the 11 children he surveyed in his initial, the 11 children, only, I mean, nine of them were Anglo-Saxon and the other two were Jewish. Similarly, about all but three families were, three of the children were girls and the rest were boys. And similarly, Leo Kanner said, quote, they represented all but three of the families were either, quote, at work, quote, either who's who in America or American men of science or both. So it was seen as this thing that caught, that was, that happened among the upper classes. And to, you know, I remember watching a documentary when doing research. There was a documentary called Refrigerator Mothers, where there was this one black mother named Dorothy Groomer who was trying to get her son Steven diagnosed. But they said that you couldn't be autistic. He couldn't be autistic because she wasn't even a refrigerator mother. And the backstory is that people thought that refrigerator mothers or unloving parents were the thing that caused autistic people. So because it was a black mother, she couldn't possibly be an unloving parent, which is really kind of the intersection of sexism and ableism and racism all in like one horrific souffle.
You also mentioned in the book that you decided to start writing when you made this decision that you wanted to start writing about autism as an autistic person, that you wanted to place yourself within a larger context of the autism narrative. And I wanted to ask you about that because in some ways the book is kind of a memoir.
Yeah.
In some ways it's not. In some ways it's a history of the way we've talked about and thought about autism. In another way, it's about policy, you know, housing and race and gender and all of those things. So it's a lot of things, this book.
Yeah. When I first started talking to people about writing this book, I think a lot of people wanted me to write a memoir because I initially wrote that piece, a piece for National Journal, basically arguing that we should stop trying to cure autistic people and help them live fulfilling lives. But A, my feeling is I'm not that particularly interesting.
You don't think, but yes, okay, keep going.
I mean, later on tonight, I'm going to be watching Disney Plus, and I'm going to order a pizza. You know, like I'm not that particularly fascinating a person. Also, I was 25 when that piece came out, so I didn't think that I could write a memoir, you know, as somebody who's 25 years old. And I don't have anything against, but like my other feeling was that I have nothing against autism memoirs. But my feeling is that a lot of times memoirs almost begin and end with that person. And as a political journalist and as a political reporter, my feeling was, well, I want to kind of universalize. And it's like, I don't want people to just, because I was worried that people would just think that, oh, wow, isn't this such an inspirational story? And oftentimes when people read inspirational stories, they don't actually, it's to inspire them to feel better. It's not to inspire people to make change. And I think that what I wanted to do was I wanted to show that I'm successful because of deliberate policy decisions. So I talk about it in the book. I was born the year that, in 1990, the year the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act was passed. Those two laws ensured I was able to live a fulfilling, a better life than people before me. Right. In the same respect, one of the things I've noticed is that throughout traveling the country, I met autistic people who were much smarter than me, harder working than I am, more innovative than I am, kinder than I am, or all these different things. But for whatever reason, we're falling through the cracks or fell through cracks that shouldn't exist. And what it showed me was that more often than not, you know, I felt that, well, I'm a political journalist, you know, and that's my calling card, and that's how I see myself. So let me report out, how did I succeed? But also, how do autistic people rise and fall? And most of the time, it's not their fault. It's not, again, it's not through personal failings. I profile a woman by the name of Aria, who does speak, who's a mom, I believe, in Pennsylvania or somewhere. And then Hari Srinivasan, and then Aria speaks and, you know, has married, has a family and all that. But for a lot of reasons, she just struggled in college. And then Hari Srinivasan is what a lot of people would consider low functioning because he doesn't speak, even though I'm not a fan of the term low functioning. And a lot of people saw him as low functioning until they gave him a chance, until they gave him a communication device. And now he's thriving at Berkeley. And he's now on the Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee. And he's doing great. And it's because people stopped seeing him as high functioning or low functioning and gave him a chance and helped him succeed. And what it said to me was that, it's usually not about whether autistic people have intellectual disabilities or whether they don't have intellectual disabilities. It's not if whether they can speak or they can't speak. A lot of times it's just about the right support systems around them. Right. You know, if there were no ramps or elevators, being in a wheelchair would suck. If there was no Braille, it would be really hard to be it was really hard to be a blind person before there was Braille. It still is really hard to be a blind person, but we get better at it, you know?
Yeah.
But for some reason, when we talk about autistic people, we start from the baseline assumption that they're failures.
Yeah. I want to, before we get too far into the conversation, I want to give you a chance to clear up some of the language points that you make in the book.
Yes.
You already mentioned, what about the terms high functioning or low functioning?
Yeah.
You're not crazy about those terms.
I'm not in love with them. And I think the reason why is high functioning and low functioning are about what non-autistic people see when they see autistic people, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's not.
And we see this big chasm in between a high functioning and a low functioning. And isn't that one of your main points, is like, there's not that much difference.
There isn't that much difference. Yeah. The thing that's when I profiled Julia Bascom, the executive director of ASAN, of the autistic self-advocacy network, and Leo Rosa, who's a 19-year-old young man in the Bay Area of California. A lot of people would think that Julia is high functioning and Leo's low functioning, but in many ways they both require a lot of supports. And that's not a bad thing, but those supports allow them to live a good and happy and fulfilling life.
So you say high and low or low support
needs. High support needs or low support needs, yeah. I tend to say.
Right.
Because that, to me, is more about what autistic people see themselves.
Yeah.
And more about what they need and less about assumptions that we have about them. High functioning and low functioning, because if you start with saying somebody is high functioning, you often sometimes erase their really legitimate needs.
Mm.
And when you talk about low functioning autistic people, you often wind up setting criminally low expectations or automatically start saying they won't amount to much. And then you say that high functioning autistic people, oh, well, we should invest a lot with them because they'll become coders in Silicon Valley. So we should really focus on them. And then we really kind of relegate or kind of ignore or kind of like dismiss, quote unquote, low functioning autistic people. When really what we should do is we should say, what do you need? Because one of the things that really annoys me is that we often talk about autism while talking past autistic people.
Eric Garcia, He's the senior Washington correspondent for The Independent. His new book is We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Can't turn the Wasatch Front into California, and we won't do that if we elect good Republicans.
Utah and California have more in common than you might think.
They both have supermajorities in their state legislatures. I'm Emily Means.
And I'm Sonia Hudson. In the newest episode of State Street, we're looking at the supermajority in Utah's legislature and how the minority party can actually make its voice heard.
Find State Street wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The political journalist Eric Garcia is our guest today. We're talking about his book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. Part of it is memoir, his own story navigating the world with autism. It's also about the history of how we've thought of autism and how we have settled into these kind of misconceptions and myths. So much of the attention and policies are about finding a cure, but Garcia says being autistic is an important part of his and others' identity. They don't want to be fixed. They want help in living their lives better. The book is called We're Not Broken. I want to ask you about an important theme in the book, this idea
Sure.
that autism needs to be cured. And let's talk about when you were a kid. You're a teenager when people started to really take notice of autism, you write. And you mentioned how this really shaped how you saw yourself. And then there's the story you tell. You're watching a program on VH1,
yeah.
on cable TV.
Yeah.
And there's the public service announcement with a lot of musicians, some of them you really love because
yeah.
you yourself are into music, which we'll get to in a minute. But talk about this public service announcement and what it was you were seeing there.
Yeah. if somebody winds up actually getting all the music references for every chapter and subtitle chapter like that, like DM me and we'll talk about that. Cause like,
yeah.
A, that's cool. B, I worry about you. So I grew up loving heavy metal music. You know, that was my language. And I was watching, this had to be around 2006, 2007. And one day I'm watching on the weekend and then there's this public service announcement with like Tommy Lee and Vince Neil from Motley Crue and Roger Daltrey from The Who and Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. And they're like, as many as one in 160 children are diagnosed. And like, that's more than 68 a day. And it's more than type 1 diabetes, childhood cancer, cystic fibrosis combined. And it's like, it's the fastest growing developmental disability in the world. And then at the end, it's like, help us put an end to autism. Initially, I liked that ad.
Hmm.
And nowadays when I watch it, I cringe. Because it's like, I don't want to be cured. And also, it's kind of like saying that autism... you can die from cystic fibrosis. You can die from complications from diabetes and childhood cancer, you know? So it's comparing this thing that I have, this disability that I have, to these very, very horrific illnesses. At the same time, it's like, it's like saying that you want to cure me, you want to put an end to this thing that really shapes who I am. And I'm reminded of what Jim Sinclair, the autistic activist, said, which is that when they said, when parents say, I wish my child did not have autism, what they're saying is, I wish the autistic child I have did not exist. And for better or for worse, like a lot of people think that like, oh, my kid's somewhere underneath all the autism. No, that's your kid. The autism is part of your kid. So like nowadays I realize, and it's like, you know, when people were freaking out about the increased diagnosis rates of autism, that was actually a good thing because we were getting better at diagnosing it. For so long, we thought of autism as this very, very narrow form of child psychosis. For a long time, it didn't even get its own diagnosis in the DSM. It was the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. For a long time, it was seen as a symptom of schizophrenia. So like it was a good thing when we got better at diagnosing. So.
Yeah.
When I go back and I think of that, I think, wow, that's a really damaging. And I have to think about what did that do to my psyche growing up, you know?
Hmm. Let me go back.
Sure.
And have you spend a few moments, Eric, explaining, as you do in the book, the history of the beginning of our understanding of autism. You mentioned Leo Kanner, this researcher at Johns Hopkins.
Yeah.
And the work that brought this awareness of the condition, but then creates all of these myths. Take us back there and take us through that, if you would, a little bit.
You know, so one of the things that's interesting is that, so autism was first really discussed in 1911 because thanks to a Swiss researcher by the name of Eugen Bleuler. And he thought of it as a symptom of schizophrenia. And then in 1943, there was a man by the name of Leo Kanner, who was a researcher at Johns Hopkins University, and he published his study, Autistic Disturbances of Affective Contact. And what happened is that even though he wrote at the time that autistic children were born with a, quote, innate inability to form typical social contact with people, he also noticed that, quote, there are very few really warm-hearted fathers and mothers. And he later told Time magazine that the children he studied were, quote, kept neatly in a refrigerator which didn't defrost.
Can you just underline what he's saying there? He's saying that based on very few impressions of people
right.
with autism.
Because it's only like 11 people, yeah.
Exactly. There's 11 people, and he's concluding and telling the world that it's because moms and dads, particularly moms, were just not warm or affectionate enough.
Right. And I don't go about this in the book, but like he also notes like how many of the mothers were working mothers. And you have to remember this is like this is in the 1930s and the 1940s when like women in the workplace is still a big no-no. This is like during World War II when women are just starting to get on the bomber assembly lines and things like that we know. And so that kind of again, I wonder, I didn't do enough research in this, but this again creates a freak out. And again, he also notes that how many fathers were kind of like those kind of absent-minded professors and kind of, you know, that kind of thing. And then what happened was, this took root with Austrian-American psychologist Bruno Bettelheim. And whereas Kanner was mostly discussed, he would occasionally be quoted in Time magazine. Bruno Bettelheim was well-known in the 1960s and 1970s. He was going on late-night television shows. He had articles in The Atlantic. And he had this book called The Empty Fortress, wherein he said that, you know, the kind of underlying idea throughout everything was this idea that autistic parents, he said, I state my belief that the precipitating factor in infantile autism is the parents' wish that the child did not exist. And Bettelheim, you have to remember, was also a survivor of Auschwitz, I believe, one of the concentration camps. And he compared the conditions of autistic children to the same kind of catatonic state that he saw people in Auschwitz. Think about that. He's basically comparing parents to Nazi prison guards. At the same time, you have parents like Bernard Rimland putting out studies basically saying that Bruno Bettelheim's studies are rubbish, you know, and saying that it isn't caused by unloving parents. But then even then, as good as Bruno Bettelheim was, and he helped found what would eventually become the Autism Society of America with Ruth Chris Sullivan, at the same time, he also was somebody who was promoting things like giving kids B12 vitamins. Or he was one of the people who really helped popularize. In fact, I think he might have been at the same. Yeah, he was at the same congressional hearing that Andrew Wakefield was at when Andrew Wakefield came stateside talking about vaccines. So, and he talked about diets and he talked about gluten-free diets helping autistic people. So, like, it was still very, very. So, what happens is you often have these new breakthroughs and revelations about autism that are often coupled with really toxic ideas about autism.
Yeah. Some of the myths that came from this early thinking you mentioned still persist. That you write about, for example, a myth that autistic people are dangerous, the myth of the autistic shooter.
Yes. This happened after the shooting at Newtown at Sandy Hook Elementary School. when it was revealed that Adam Lanza was on the autism spectrum, or at least had a diagnosis. It led to a surge in calls to Autism Speaks. And on top of that, if you remember earlier this week, this year, there was the Capitol rioter and the QAnon shaman, you know, the guy with the horns who you like you saw. His lawyer tried to use him being autistic as an excuse for his raiding the Capitol. And similarly, lawyers for Dylann Roof, the white supremacist who killed those people in Charleston, who killed black people in Charleston. His lawyers have tried to use autism as an excuse. And as a result, it's made people think that autism causes mass shootings, when really it doesn't. There's little to no, there's no evidence whatsoever. There was talks about, there were people trying to debunk this in the 1990s, before the idea of mass shooters was even a thing in pop culture. So it's a simplistic argument that makes people feel better. And makes it feel like they're doing something, because if they can fix the autism, then we won't have mass shootings, you know?
Yeah. I want to break through a few of the sections in the book, one about education. And let's start with your own experience. Sure. You went to Chaffey College, a community college at first. Eventually, you go to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Really amazing journalistic program that you started to that you studied.
Yeah.
But you tell the story in the book. This was just 2 months into your time at UNC. And you blow this exam in a music class.
Yeah.
And you are feeling desperate. And you have this really important experience with one of your professors where you reveal that you were autistic. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, we could talk about that. So what happened is I bombed this test, and it was literally like I just froze. I just couldn't think. And I tried memorizing everything the night before, and I tried studying, and I'd study with a partner. And I just realized, and up until then, I hadn't really asked for accommodations because I just didn't think it was important.
Yeah.
And also I kind of thought that, well, if I'm here, I must not be really disabled. Right. So I just didn't think about it, which like, it's a really screwed up way of thinking about it, right? Because disabled people go to university all the time. But then I also thought that, like, well, I'm not really disabled and I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be getting special treatment. Then finally, I was just like, okay, uncle, I go to my professor and I was like, I'm on the autism spectrum. I'm autistic. I have trouble. I need help. And immediately what he did is he picked it, instead of judging me, his name was David Peer. I'll never forget it. He called the disability office. And he's like, and he said, I have a student here, XYZ. And he says, they're waiting for you. Go. Now, and then I did. And then I got a count, you know, after that, I met my counsel, the woman who would become my guidance counselor, Teresa Maitland, who was phenomenal, who was an angel. And then, you know, that helped me plan out my weeks. That helped me. And I thrived at UNC after that. I started exercising. I started doing all these things, you know. And like I succeeded and I graduated, of course, but like I think to myself, what if I'd been like an hour late, you know, and he was gone from campus? Or what if he had said, oh, well, this kid's just wanted to get extra accommodated, like just wants a pass for bombing his test, you know? And I think about that a lot. And I think about like, you know, that, and that happens more often than not, that a lot of times when you go to ask for accommodations, professors will blow it off, or they'll say, maybe you're just not smart enough to be here, or they'll flat out deny you're disabled because you're at university, you know? So,
yeah.
So a lot of times that doesn't happen. And also I never took another class with Dr. David Peer again, but I'm always going to be grateful for him.
What does that tell you about the way people with autism are treated in general, in academia, in education in general? And are things, do you see things changing? You got lucky.
Yeah.
But if we have to rely on that kind of luck, that's a problem.
That is it's a big problem. I think that, I mean, it's been a while since I've been in university, but there's a few things there, right? Like there's the fact that the onus is on the student to disclose is a problem, because then you have to go and disclose, and then it's dependent on whether the professor believes you and all of that. And then on top of that, there's what if the proper accommodations aren't there, or what if they don't want to give you the accommodations, or what if you're not, quote unquote, not disabled enough to get the accommodations? There's all of these different variables and factors that go into whether somebody gets the services they need, right?
Yeah. I want to ask about another experience that happens because I'm really taken by the story about your connection to music.
Yeah.
And there's you had a music teacher, John Paul Trotter. And one thing that interested me was something that you wrote, that it was John Paul who noticed that you like the stories behind the music almost as much as the music itself. What's that about?
Yeah. So like, I mean, when I wanted to impress him, I would just buy a bunch of, I wanted to learn as much as I could about music. So I would buy a bunch of magazines and I learned the stories behind songs. Hmm. And like, I learned that like, oh, this song was written by Stevie Wonder, but then he gave it to Jeff Beck and all this stuff. Or I learned the stories behind like AC/DC or Guns N' Roses or all this. And then like, I would tell him these stories while he was teaching me. And he's like, have you ever thought about being a music journalist? And I'd never thought, but like, and that was around the time when I was a teenager, when my parents were like, okay, buddy, you need to find a real job, you know? Cause I wanted to be a professional musician.
Yeah.
You know,
I wanted to shred.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I wanted to shred. I wanted to play Ozfest or something, you know? yeah. But like, you know, but you know, that was like, okay, that seems like it could be cool. Like I could still be around music. I could still meet interesting people and travel the world and travel the country. That seems like, and I could still be near the music and the smoke, so to speak. So that was what attracted me to that.
Here's the thing. This is the reason I asked that question.
Sure.
Because there's the part of me that when I do these interviews, I'm like, oh, let me look for the cues about Eric's autism.
Yeah.
Now, that's got to be annoying, though. And I find myself in a lot of these, when I'm working through the stories you tell in the book, to try to sort of step away from just defining the story based on your autism. That's got to be irritating for you.
You know, it's funny because I talk with a friend of mine, who Sarah Marshall, who runs the amazing podcast You're Wrong About. And yeah. She has ADHD. And she said something a few episodes ago where she said, like, I have ADHD and ADHD has me. And like, she is just like, we live with each other. And at one point, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, because like at one point somebody like, for a long time, I wondered, where do I begin and where do I end and the autism begins?
Yeah.
And the answer really is there's no end and there's no beginning. That's me and that's them and that's autism. And it's kind of at some point we just become inseparable. And you can't, you know, what is an autistic journalist? It's a journalist who's autistic, you know, or yeah. What's an autistic waiter at Denny's? You know, it's clearly a waiter at Denny's who's autistic, you know? Would a neurotypical waiter serve me my pancakes in a way different way than autistic waiter? Maybe, but you can't. I don't know if I could say that an autistic waiter would serve me pancakes autistically, you know.
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
don't think that I write autistically, or I don't know, or if I do, I don't know how I write autistically, because at this point it's just me.
Yeah, there's also this thing you write about when you know. Look, you're a really successful guy. You got work as a political journalist. You've been with Market Watch and Roll Call and The Hill and The Washington Post. But you write about – you say when you're talking about that, this is the part of the story where people think, oh, there's a happy ending here. He overcame his autism.
Yeah.
But this is part of that narrative that you're trying to push up against, this idea of a – like, as you say, this hyper savant who found a super skill and made it work. Talk a little bit about that impression that some of us come to.
You mean why I hate that narrative?
Yes, yes.
Because it's a happy ending for neurotypical people. It doesn't serve autistic people. It's for neurotypical people to say, oh, my kid can be okay. We don't ask what happens in different workplaces. I've worked in different workplaces where I thrived and where I completely bombed. And so it's not a linear thing. And on top of that, I think a lot of times we forget that a lot of autistic people might be stuck at jobs because they're afraid of losing them because they're worried they can't get into anything else. So it really comes down to, rather than like this happy ending, it's like, okay, how do we make workplaces? Because, like, again, the reason I hate, I think, and I just thought of this right now, so I didn't even really think about it in the book, but I think, but the reason why I hate those stories is because they almost never require the employers to change. I think that's why I hate those that narrative.
Eric Garcia, his book is We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Public radio brings you vital information and it keeps you company whatever your day looks like, providing moments of levity and joy along with the news. Stay connected at home. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name.
It's easy to hear the news that you trust when you tell your smart speaker, play KUER. To learn more about listening with your smart speaker, go to KUER.org/smartspeaker.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the political journalist Eric Garcia. We're talking about his book, We're Not Broken. Eric, I want to come back to one of these pervasive myths about autism.
Sure.
And it's probably the most pernicious, or one of them anyway, and that is that autism is caused by vaccines. Like, part of me doesn't even want to spend any time with this.
Yeah, I mean,
right?
Yeah.
But say something about it, because clearly we're in a state right now where vaccines are a question. What do you want to say about that? We don't have to say much, but say something.
If the autism vaccine panic was The Hobbit, we're in the Lord of the Rings of an anti-vaccine panic, so to speak.
Yeah.
The vaccine panic we see now was laid down by Andrew Wakefield and Jim Carrey and Jenny McCarthy and all those things I can't say on the radio because I have very choice words for them. And that's why, to your point, why I probably only devote like 5 pages overall in my book to them, because it's such a – because I think that what happened is, once again, is that, A, it's not true. It's completely false. It's been debunked study after study after study. Andrew Wakefield, the originator of that, like the original study guy, he lost his medical license. The study was retracted in The Lancet in 2010. So like it's done. But the damage was done because that study was put out in 1998. The study wasn't retracted until 2010. That's 12 years that it permeated the zeitgeist. And again, I talk about it in the book that, like, the first time I saw it was on CNN with Larry King interviewing Jenny McCarthy. And I asked my mom, I was like, did I become autistic after the vaccines? And she's like, what are you talking about? Because my mom didn't know anything about it. But, like, that became – and, like, that's on CNN. That's not, like, on, some random dude's blog, And so it gave the imprimatur of credibility, just like Jenny McCarthy going on Oprah. And I know this book is never going to be on Oprah's book club, given how negatively I write about her. But she again gave the imprimatur to Jenny McCarthy by allowing her on her television show. And she's one, Oprah Winfrey, lover or hater, she's one of the most influential people in media. And she allowed this really terrible thing to go on her television show. So we live with this nightmare. And more importantly, once again, more than the actual just public health disaster that it's caused. Once again, the problem is that it says that autism is something to be avoided, and that having autism is bad, and that autistic people are a burden on the family,
Yeah.
It's a terrible idea. And it leads to really bad things like forcing kids to drink bleach or, a lot of other terrible things. So.
Or just not getting vaccinated.
Just not getting vaccinated. And it's important to remember that, literally 2 months into him running for president, Donald Trump talked about vaccines on the debate stage running for president. And, you know, I've covered politics long enough to know that, like, Trump's supporters take his word as gospel. You know, and they, you know, we're reaping what anti-vaxxers have sowed.
There's another thing I wanted to ask you about that comes in this section about healthcare, and it's the idea of trauma. And you mentioned Carl Montgomery. You can talk about who he is, but just the idea that Carl says that we, and I'm just quoting from the book, we don't know what autism
yes.
in and of itself looks like. We only know how autism informed by trauma prevents itself.
Yeah.
What is he getting at there?
Presents itself. Yeah. Like, I mean, I think that, like, that's by the time you get the diagnosis, people have been wondering what's wrong with you for so long. Hmm. Or parents have spent God knows how much money, or you spent or if you're an adult and you get diagnosed, you've spent God knows how many years being misunderstood. So as a result, you're just traumatized by the slings and arrows of life. And so that manifests in how you live. It leaves scars on you. And at some point, you don't know where the trauma ends and the autism begins. And so we don't know what it looks like. We really don't.
What can you say about, there's a section you write about relationships
yeah.
and about love. What did you, you mentioned, Corey, we could talk about Corey and Chris. Corey's from Utah. Maybe you could say something about their story.
Yeah, they are, you know, so I went to go visit them, Chris and Corey Williams, and they're both autistic. They have three lovely autistic kids. And it was through them diagnosing their daughter, Cassidy, that they realized that they were autistic. So Corey is self-diagnosed, and it came through really realizing that she had a lot of similarities with her daughter. And one of the other things that I would really, really emphasize was just that them being autistic doesn't make them bad parents. It actually helps them understand their children better than anybody else could. And it makes them just fantastic mom and dad to their kids.
Do you think there's still the impression that it's a little risky to have
two
people with autism been in care of, you know, being in charge of kids and a mortgage and all of that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, that's not to say that they didn't have trouble, you know, just like any other family. But like, a lot of times people just think that, like, you know, how could they ever do that? Like, I mean, you know, it's funny. In 1988, Edward Ritvo published a paper called 11 Possibly Autistic Parents. And he said that if he hadn't included the word possibly in the title, the paper would have been rejected. This was in 1988 because nobody believed it. You know, autism comes from somewhere, you know? You know, you get it from genetics. So DNA. So there's a chance that one of your parents or another is neurodivergent in some way. Yeah.
What are you hoping, Eric, to see? What sort of maybe reforms or transformations in attitudes or behavior? What are you hoping for in terms of that from the book?
It's funny. I remember reading an interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates after he put out the case for reparations. And he said he didn't actually expect reparations to happen. He just wanted people to stop laughing at the idea. And what's funny is that piece is like, 7 years old now? And like, the presidential candidates are talking about reparations now, you know? Yeah. In the same way, more than any policy, we could talk about policies like ending subminimum wage labor or funding home and community-based care or all that.
Yeah.
More than that, and I'm not discounting that, but more than anything, I just want people to stop laughing at the idea that autistic people should be included in any discussion that determines their fate. Because until we get that, it doesn't matter how much money we spend or what programs we do. They're going to fail.
Yeah. There's this thing that you mentioned, John Marble.
Yeah.
It's one of the characters you mentioned in the book. And he said something that I wanted to ask you about. This was helpful for me in understanding this. You write that the more you talk to and interview autistic people, the more that you're reminded of this analogy that John Marble comes up with, likening autistic to being French.
Yes. So John Marble is an autistic man who lives in who worked in the Obama administration, and he got diagnosed while he was working in the Obama administration. So he's the second openly autistic person ever to work in a presidential appointee to work in an administration. Openly. And what he said is that, like, and then now he works in the Bay Area helping autistic people find work. So he said that there's, you know, he pointed out that there's millions of different ways to be French. You could be a gay fashion designer in Paris or a Catholic nun in Bordeaux, but, and they're going to be radically different, but they still have this kind of esprit de corps, to borrow from the French. They have this kind of general mutual understanding. Just like you and I, we're Americans. You live in Utah. I grew up in California, and I live in Washington, D.C. California is a blue state, you know, in California, you know, Utah is a red state, but we still have a mutual understanding. It's kind of changing these days as we become more polarized, but you and I still have, you and I still have a mutual understanding of what it means to be an American. And you and I still have, even though, you know, with all, everything, you know, I'm autistic, you might not be autistic, or who knows, you know, but like, we still have these kind of common threads between us and ties that bind us that really happened after the Civil War, when America became America and the United States, when the United States went from being plural to singular, you know. And in the same way, the more I've met and interviewed different autistic people, the more I realize that our differences are not as big as our similarities. And when we understand that, then we can understand each other, and then we can speak, then we can work to improve each other's lives. Sorry, that's an ambulance behind me.
I was going to say, dude, you're in DC. Yeah. So what do you expect?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So, yeah, no, I don't live near the motorcade, so don't worry.
Got it. Okay. Okay.
But you know, we have this mutual understanding as autistic people, and you know, I read in the book that we would, that, you know, at one point I went to this retreat in Michigan called Autspace, and what was funny about it is that even though we were all different variations of autism, we could be ourselves. And we could probably, and I remember thinking to myself, oh, wow, this is probably the first time I could see autistic people being autistic and not having to perform for the neurotypicals. And it was great, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like, it was so interesting the way, like, Mel Bags, for example.
Yeah.
The way Mel explains communication.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up Mel Bags. God rest their soul. You know, they
and we should mention Mel uses the pronouns
they them. Yes, yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. The late Mel Bags. They died last year. Yeah. And they really say that it's fascinating to me that, like, they say, I'll just quote directly from them. I find it interesting that the failure to learn your language is seen as a deficit, but a failure to learn my language is seen as so natural that people like me are officially described as mysterious and puzzling rather than anyone admitting that it is themselves who are confused. Mm.
Describe the YouTube video that they put out in 2007.
Yeah, that was, yeah, it's called In My Language. And the first half is them making noises and running their hands against cold water and scraping their fingernails against a stepladder, nuzzling their face against a magazine. And people don't realize, and what's funny, again, this shows a similar, those things, if you're autistic, you might think that I'm different from Mel, but those things feel awesome if you're autistic, because you constantly need to be stimulated. And then the second half is them using these words that they typed spoken over, like as a voiceover. And it showed that basically those two ways are equally valid ways of communicating. Right. And it's a really, I urge people to if they want to understand autism more, I urge people to watch that video. Because, you know,
you said it articulated everything you wanted.
Yeah. If you don't buy my book, urge you to watch Mel's video. They say everything that I could have said.
Finally, Eric, you described the book as a love letter to autistic people. What do you mean?
Again, I say, you know, we're taught for so long that we're a burden to people. We're taught that it's bad that we're that somebody failed and gave us the wrong shot that made us autistic. We're forced to go through, you know, in some places in the country, you know, we're subjected to shock therapy. Or we're paid below the minimum wage because it's legal to do that. I want autistic people to not have to hate themselves. I want autistic people to know that they matter and that the things that they that what goes on in their heads and what goes on, how they interact with the world, is just as valid as everything else. And I say this from the bottom of my twisted black heart, is that meeting and interviewing autistic people and doing this journey that of writing this book taught me not to hate myself. And it helped me learn to love myself as an autistic person and helped me understand myself better. So I hope the thing that bleeds out from the page is how much I love autistic people.
Eric Garcia, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Eric Garcia is the senior Washington correspondent for The Independent. His book is called We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Stu Nolan. The program is produced by Carrie Watson, by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.